So our second reading, page 59, Exodus 7, 1 to 6. We read last week, but we need this as a bit of background for this week as well. So Exodus 7, 1 to 6. So let's hear the word of the Lord together. And the Lord said to Moses, "See, I have made you like God to Pharaoh, and your brother Aaron shall be your prophet. You shall speak all that I command you, and your brother Aaron shall tell Pharaoh to let the people of Israel go out of his land. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart. And though I multiply my signs and wonders in the land of Egypt, Pharaoh will not listen to you. Then I will lay my hand on Egypt and bring my hosts, my people, the children of Israel, out of the land of Egypt by great acts of judgment. The Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring out the people of Israel from among them." Moses and Aaron did so. They did just as the Lord commanded them. Then over in chapter 9, verse 13, so there are these 10 plagues. We're just going to read the 7th plague. So 9:13. "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Rise up early in the morning and present yourself before Pharaoh and say to him, Thus says the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, let my people go that they may serve me. For this time I will send all my plagues on you yourself and on your servants and your people so that you may know that there is none like me in all the earth. For by now I could have put out my hand and struck you and your people with pestilence, and you would have been cut off from the earth. But for this purpose I have raised you up, to show you my power, so that my name may be proclaimed in all the earth. You are still exalting yourself against my people and will not let them go. Behold, about this time tomorrow I will cause very heavy hail to fall, such has never been in Egypt from the day it was founded until now. Now therefore send, get your livestock and all that you have in the field into safe shelter, for every man and beast that is in the field and is not brought home will die when the hail falls on them." Then whoever feared the word of the Lord among the servants of Pharaoh hurried his slaves and his livestock into the houses, but whoever did not pay attention to the word of the Lord left his slaves and his livestock in the field. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand towards heaven so that there may be hail in all the land of Egypt, on man and beast and every plant of the field in the land of Egypt." Then Moses stretched out his staff towards heaven, and the Lord sent thunder and hail, and fire ran down to the earth. And the Lord rained hail upon the land of Egypt. There was hail and fire flashing continually in the midst of the hail, very heavy hail, such as never been in all the land of Egypt since it became a nation. The hail struck down everything that was in the field in all the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and the hail struck down every plant of the field, and broke every tree of the field. Only in the land of Goshen, where the people of Israel were, was there no hail. Then Pharaoh sent and called Moses and Aaron and said to them, "This time I have sinned. The Lord is in the right, and I and my people are in the wrong. Plead with the Lord, for there has been enough of God's thunder and hail. I will let you go, and you shall stay no longer." Moses said to him, "As soon as I've gone out of the city, I'll stretch out my hands to the Lord. The thunder will cease, and there'll be no more hail, so that you may know that the earth is the Lord's. But as for you and your servants, I know that you do not yet fear the Lord. The flax and the barley were struck down, for the barley was in the ear and the flax was in bud, but the wheat and the emmer were not struck down, for they are late in coming up." So Moses went out of the city from Pharaoh and stretched out his hands to the Lord. And the thunder and the hail ceased, and the rain no longer poured upon the earth. But when Pharaoh saw that the rain and the hail and the thunder had ceased, he sinned yet again and hardened his heart, he and his servants. So the heart of Pharaoh was hardened, and he didn't let the people of Israel go, just as the Lord had spoken through Moses. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go into Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart and the heart of his servants, that I may show these signs of mine among them, and that you may tell in the hearing of your son and of your grandson how I dealt harshly with the Egyptians, and what signs I have done among them, that you may know that I am the Lord." Domino's Pizza have something called Make a Pizza Legend. I don't know if you've ever tried this, but I thought we'd give it a go together. So Matt is going to help us here on the screen. So basically you create it, you name it, and then you fame it. So we're going to create our own legend here, and we're going to do this together as a group exercise. So maybe we'll do it by tables. Perhaps with this table down here, do you want the first of all you have to choose? Is that size and crust?
Yeah, size and crust.
Can you see the options there or not?
Hot dogs, stuffed crust. Domino's, stuffed crust.
Just go for one of them. Okay, next option is topping, is it?
Yeah.
Next table, topping, what do you want? Good. Next we have the cheese. Two options. Okay, this is your table. Mozzarella, it's got to be mozzarella. Next one is the toppings. Oh, no, what's this? The, what do they call these? Ah, we've maxed out on toppings. That's what you get for being greedy. Okay, now I don't quite understand this, but you've got to add some awesome. So, oh, there we go. A bit of soul. Bit of stardust, very good. Next we've got, okay, the moment.
It's
family time, are we happy with that? Okay. And now we've got to come up with a name for this thing. So any ideas of a name for the barge pizza?
Barge pizza.
Okay. That's what the people want. The barge pizza, the top line. Bargey McBarge face. Okay. Then Matt sticks in his name. And then bring my legend to life. And da-da-da, this is the magic moment. There you go at the bottom. If you scroll it, there you go. Show me my legend. There it is. Well, we don't need to, no, okay, that's going to show us the whole thing again, the little video of what we've made. But there we go. And then if you want at the end, we can actually order this thing that we've created. Put Pete's details down. He'll pay for it. Yeah, one a table. Great. So that's how you do it. Now you know. That's creating your. Thanks, Matt. That's creating your pizza legend and bringing it to life. It is not like that with God. It is not like that with God. We do not create God. We don't decide what God is like. We don't get to choose what qualities or character we want him to have. Sometimes people play that game. They say, you know, I like to think of God as, or for me, God is, dot, dot, dot. That's just playing games. That's fantasy land. That's sort of Harry Potter territory. In reality, it is not like that. So in the real world, we don't create God. He creates us. And he then reveals to us what he is like. That is what we find in the book of Exodus, so set in about 1500 BC. This account of how the Israelites, enslaved in Egypt, were rescued from the land of slavery by God. But the book begins in the first few chapters with God revealing what he is like. So we've seen before that in chapter 3, God appeared to Moses in the burning bush and told him his name. His name is the Lord, the I Am, eternally existing, incomparable. And now in chapters 7 through to 10, he reveals more of what he is like, this time not just in his words, but in his works. So not just in what he says, but in what he does. These chapters are the account of the 10 plagues that God sends on the Egyptians. And these plagues are described in chapter 10, verses 1 and 2, as being signs. But signs of what? What is being displayed on the sign? Well, they display what God is like. So that is their purpose. Their purpose is to reveal more of what God is like. And this point is made some 7 times in these chapters. So inside your service sheet there, you've got an outline. At the bottom, footnote 1, you've got these 7 references explaining what the purpose is. And I'm just going to read them to you. So 7:17, what's the point of the plagues? By this, as in by these plagues, you shall know that I am the Lord. 8:10, so that you may know that there is no one like the Lord our God. 8:22, that you may know that I am the Lord in the midst of the earth. 9:14, so that you may know that there is none like me in all the earth. 9:16, so that my name may be proclaimed in all the earth. 9:29, so that you may know that the earth is the Lord's. And 10:2, that you may know that I am the Lord. He wants the whole world to know that he, the Lord, is God, and to know what he is like. And the plagues put that on display for the whole world to see. At the London Marathon today, we got to see on a global stage what these runners can do, what Kipchoge can do and all the rest of them, and Kipsang. At the Olympics in Rio this summer, the athletes will be on display showing the world what they can do. And that is what God is doing in these plagues. He's showing the world what he is like. He's showing the world what he is made of. The time for talking is over, as they say before a big game of football. Time for talking is over. So what is he like, the God who is actually there? Firstly, in these acts of judgment, the Lord shows his power, his incomparable, absolute, sovereign power. Where do we see that? Well, for a start, we see it in his total control of the situation. The plagues are actually very carefully ordered in three groups of three, leading up to the showstopper plague, so that the tenth plague. So that there's nothing random, there's nothing haphazard at all about these plagues. It's planned, they're designed. This is a model, if you like, of advanced strategic planning. This is a chess grandmaster who's got all the moves mapped out in advance. Knows exactly what he's going to do. And the Lord knows exactly how things are going to pan out. So it's not as if the Lord is caught out by Pharaoh not listening. So it's not a question of God saying, well, I can't believe that plague one didn't work. Right, we're going to have to think of another one. What can we come up with for plague two? Let's try this one instead. He knows from the outset that Pharaoh will not listen. He says in chapter 7, verse 4, he says to Moses, before it all kicks off, he says, Pharaoh will not listen to you. Back in chapter 4, verse 22, he says to Moses that only the tenth plague will do the trick. The Lord knows that before he begins the whole thing. Then we see God's power in his defeat of Pharaoh, this superpower confrontation. Egypt, the superpower of the day, the gods the Egyptians worshipped, seemed to be in charge. Pharaoh, the most powerful man on the planet, but up against the Lord, it's a completely one-sided contest. In chapter 7, verse 4, God says, I will lay my hand on Egypt. 7:5, the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand. And these 10 rounds in the ring with God enable us to see the power of God's hand. You see, the Lord could have knocked them out in the first round if he'd wanted to. He could have gone straight to plague 10 if he'd wanted to, skip the other 9. Why bother with the other 9 when he knew that Pharaoh wasn't going to listen? Well, the 10 rounds in the ring, if you like, they give us 10 opportunities to see the Lord's power on display. Do you remember the famous Rumble in the Jungle boxing match in 1974, showing my age a bit there, in Kinshasa. Muhammad Ali up against George Foreman, who was the undefeated heavyweight world champion. But Ali put him in his place, and he showed the world what he can do. He showed the world that he is the greatest, the undisputed world champion. And so the Lord here shows that he alone is God. 9:14, he says that you may know that there is none like me in all the earth. But why these particular acts? So 10th plague is clear enough, isn't it? So we had in chapter 4, verse 22 in a previous week, the Lord spells out that because Pharaoh won't let God's firstborn son go, God's firstborn son being his people, Pharaoh is going to lose his firstborn son. So the reason for the 10th plague is very clear. What's the link between the other 9? Water turning to blood, frogs, gnats, flies, livestock dying, boils, hail, locusts, darkness. Well, isn't it that they're all to do with the natural world, with creation? And these are creation reversals. So just as the Lord powerfully created in the beginning, he can just as easily decreate. So he can make animals harm humans rather than serve them. He can turn light to darkness. Water becomes a source of death rather than life. And then just as easily, God can restore order again. The climax of the creation account in Genesis is the creation of humans. The climax of this account in Exodus and the plague is the destruction of humans. The Lord is showing that he has creation at his fingertips. He has absolute power. On the 27th of August 1883, there was a volcanic eruption on the Indonesian island of Krakatoa. And the force of that eruption was felt around the world, literally around the world. So the sound of that eruption was heard 3,000 miles away. And the shock waves of that eruption were recorded passing over the Greenwich Observatory, just over the river there, 7,000 miles away from that eruption. The power had been there before in the earth, but on that day, that power was unleashed for the whole world to see. And so in these plagues, we see God's awesome power put on display for the world to see. And the extent of his power is seen in reaching even to the human heart. Pharaoh's heart, that is his inner person, is very much in focus in this account. So his heart is hardened against God. And sometimes the references say, and they're there in footnote 5 on your sheet, sometimes the references say, sort of neutrally, Pharaoh's heart remained hardened. Sometimes it says, Pharaoh hardened his heart, so he's the active agent. But then on 6 occasions, it says that the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart. Now that is sovereign power, isn't it? To be able to control even the thoughts and the attitudes and the responses of your enemy. That is scary power. That is frightening power. The Lord has that power. And those who oppose him, he can harden in judgment on them. I was reading an account by a dad who went on a fairground ride with his 4-year-old daughter. There was this small sort of traveling carnival thing that was passing through his hometown. And he saw this ride in the distance at the fairground. And it had sort of long arms that looked like the tentacles of some giant octopus. And so he says, you know, with bravado and so on, he said, I decided to live a little and have a good time that would make a lasting impression on my little girl. She would discover that Dad wasn't afraid to try something new. He goes on, we boarded the monster, and soon it was spinning around at breakneck speed, while tentacles frantically lashed up and down. It was frightening. I began to worry that one of the tentacles, the one that held us, could possibly tear loose with all the contortions it was going through. We wouldn't survive if it did. I silently prayed and vowed to God as I held Jennifer tightly against my chest. It went something like this. God, if you get us off this ride alive and in one piece, I promise never to get on another ride for the rest of my life. God answered my prayer. The octopus let go, and I have kept that vow. That guy had seriously misunderestimated, as Bush would have said, what that ride was like. Pharaoh made the same mistake with God. We must not underestimate God, domesticate God, put him in a box. He isn't some sort of pint-size toy God. He isn't a sort of put-him-in-your-pocket God. He has awesome power, which he has put on display in these acts of judgment. But that was then, all those years ago. What about now? How does the Lord show his power in acts of judgment now? That is, what is the fulfillment of this? There are three horizons, I think, on which this is worked out. I'll put on the sheet there. So firstly, in the present, God is at work in this world in powerful acts of judgment. Acts of decreation, things like natural disasters, wars. This is unpacked in the book of Revelation in particular, where it talks about, you've got the cycle of the seven seals in Revelation 6, seven trumpets, Revelation 8 and 9, seven plagues in Revelation 15, 16. God's powerful acts of judgment in the present are also seen in him handing rebel society over to the power of sin. And Romans chapter 1 unpacks what that is like. It's also seen in God hardening the hearts of those who oppose him, as Romans 9, 17 to 18 explains. It says he hardens whomever he wills. People sometimes say, don't they, you know, maybe I'll make time for God when I'm a bit older. I'm not interested in that sort of stuff now. But the warning here is that God may harden the heart of such a person in judgment on them, so that when they are older, they can't turn to him. By that stage, their heart has become set like concrete. Then the second horizon is on the last day. That is when God's absolute power will be turned in final judgment on all his enemies, both spiritual and human. What hope is there? Well, the third horizon is the cross. In the ministry of Jesus, so in his teaching and his miracles, the Lord showed his power again in acts of judgment against the enemy, against his enemies of sin and sickness and demons and death. And then this ultimate superpower confrontation came to a head on the cross. The cross was an act of judgment in which the spiritual enemies of God were defeated. John 12:31 says, Jesus says, speaking of the cross, "Now will the ruler of this world," that is the devil, "be cast out." Colossians 2:15 says that on the cross he disarmed the rulers and authorities and he put them to open shame by triumphing over them in Christ. The cross, I mean, it seemed, didn't it, like a moment of ultimate weakness. But that was because the Lord had turned his awesome power on himself. The plagues of judgment were turned on him as Jesus suffered in our place. The darkness as he hung there on the cross. The flies, presumably. The firstborn dying. And the resurrection was then an act of judgment as well, in which the last great enemy, death itself, was defeated. What is the take-home from this? Well, the take-home is quite simply, do not mess with God. Don't mess with God. This is what the God who is there is actually like. He has frightening total power, and he uses it in judgment on his enemies. So do not oppose him. You will not win. You cannot win. Pharaoh learned the lesson the hard way. So instead, submit to him and get on his side and become one of his people and come to the cross where the victory was won. Hearing what God is actually like, you may well feel you don't like what you're hearing. A God with that kind of power, using it in judgment. You know, I don't like the sound of that. I think I'll sort of make my own pizza. Thank you very much. But we need to see, secondly, that in acts of judgment, the Lord shows not just his power, but also his justice. If God was just wanting to show his power, you could say, well, hasn't he already done that pretty well in creating the world? That was a pretty powerful display. You see, his acts of judgment here in the plagues, they don't just show his power, they show his justice. Pharaoh was a cruel and ruthless dictator. Exodus is a story of oppression and slavery. So the Egyptians had enslaved a whole people group. They were working them to death. Exodus is a story of genocide and ethnic cleansing in which the Hebrew baby boys were being killed off. The sins of Egypt were piled up to heaven. Their guilt was undeniable. The plague judgments on them were perfectly just. God's acts of judgment were, back then and always are, perfectly just. You know the expression, to have a skeleton in your closet? Basically means that you have some shameful secret that you want to keep hidden. And you don't want to tell anybody about it because you're afraid if people find this out, they're going to reject you and they're not going to want to have anything to do with you. You've got a skeleton in your closet. Could be the fact that years ago you were involved in some hit-and-run accident in your car. And nobody knows about it. It's just a skeleton in your closet. And you're afraid that if people knew, they wouldn't want anything to do with you. Could be that you're direct descendant of Hitler or something. And it's there on your family tree. And nobody, could be that you're an Arsenal supporter and you just, you know. Sometimes we treat God's judgment like that. We think it's a skeleton in God's closet. It's this deep, dark, shameful secret that we need to keep hidden away from people because it's so shameful it will put them off wanting to know him or have anything to do with him at all. But God does not think like that, and neither should we. So his judgment is not some skeleton he's hiding away in a closet. It is something he puts on display on the world stage for the whole world to see. God is just, and he will see that justice is done, and that is a good thing. It is not something to be embarrassed about. It is something to celebrate. Last year, seven men from Bristol were sentenced up to 24 years in prison after being convicted of sex crimes against children. The gang raped and abused babies and toddlers and children under five in attacks which they streamed on the internet for other paedophiles to watch. They groomed families to get to the children, and in one case, they even targeted a pregnant woman in order to abuse her baby after it was born. Is the sentencing of those seven men something to be embarrassed about? Not at all. It is something to celebrate that they have been brought to justice. Justice is a good thing. That the God who is there is just is something to celebrate. And the book of Revelation reveals that in heaven they sing of God's justice and his judgments, and they praise him for it. The universe would be a terrifying place if God wasn't just. Just imagine if one of those seven men was actually on the throne of the universe. Intolerance can be a beautiful thing. To be intolerant of abuse, to be intolerant of oppression, to be intolerant of racism and injustice, it is a beautiful thing, and God is intolerant. One organization that works to fight against human trafficking is called Hope for Justice. Hope for justice. That is what we want, and that is what we've got. That is what the Lord is like. The problem, though, is that all of us deserve justice, not just the paedophiles. We live in a world which is under God's judgment. A world that is experiencing God's justice in the present, in acts of judgment, natural disasters, society handed over to the power of sin, individuals hardened against God. The fact that one in one people die. God's acts of judgment are all around us. Even so, there is a lot of wrong in our world, isn't there, that people seem to be getting away with. But the Bible tells us that a day of final and ultimate justice is coming, and then justice will be served finally and fully on all God's enemies. And it will be a great day of celebration. But the question is, how will you fare on that day? Given God is perfectly just, where will that leave you? Where will it leave me? None of us have kept his law. None of us have lived as we should. All of us have gone our own way. What hope do any of us have? Well, our only hope is the death of Jesus for us. Because the cross was God's great act of judgment on sin. At one level, we could say it was the greatest act of injustice ever committed. Christ, the sinless one, unjustly punished. But he willingly suffered that injustice to take the punishment we justly deserve. If we accept that, we have nothing to fear from the judgment to come. Which brings us to our final point, that in acts of judgment, the Lord shows his love. In the Exodus plague, God makes a distinction between his people and those who aren't his people. So between his people and the Egyptians. So the judgments don't fall on his people. 8:22, for example, the Lord says about plague number four. But on that day, I will set apart the land of Goshen where my people dwell so that no swarms of flies shall be there. Or chapter 9, verse 4, about plague five. It says the Lord will make a distinction between the livestock of Israel and the livestock of Egypt. 9:26, about plague 7, we had this in the reading. Only in the land of Goshen, where the people of Israel were, was there no hail. 10:23, about plague 9, all the people of Israel had light where they lived. And so with plague 10 as well. You see, because of his love for his people, he spares them and he protects them. There's a lovely picture you can see online of Muhammad Ali, who is holding his baby girl Lila in his arms. I was going to put it on the screen, but it's one of these Getty images you have to pay for. So anyway, you can go and see it afterwards. The same mighty hand that's used to strike down his opponents, people like George Foreman, knock him out, that same mighty hand is used to hold his child close and to protect her. And it's the same with the Lord, that the mighty hand, the same mighty hand that he uses to strike his enemies with plagues, he uses to hold his children close to him and protect them. These plagues in Exodus, they're a bit like precision guided laser bombs that take out God's enemies, but they leave his people unscathed. There's no collateral damage, sort of smart weapons. In his love, the Lord spares his people from these acts of judgment. And in his love, he uses these acts of judgment to set his people free. His acts of judgment on his enemies are actually acts of love for his people. And again, it's a little bit like that with the, the abusers I mentioned, the paedophile ring. Taking down that paedophile ring, that was not just an act of justice against them. It was also an act of love. It was an act of love for the victims and the victims' families. And it is the same with God. But notice that in his judgments, we even see his love for his enemies. In the passage I read, chapter 9, verses 18 to 21, the plague of hail, God warns his enemies of what is coming. And he does that so they can take action and they can avoid the judgment. And some do. Some obey and they are saved. And when we get up to chapter 12, verse 38, we'll read that it says, in the end, a mixed multitude escaped from Egypt. It implies that some Egyptians actually escaped as well and went with God's people. God's love for his enemies is such that he warns them of the coming judgment so that they can escape it. And so today, in acts of judgment, God shows his love. Love for his people in the first place, in that he set them free from the kingdom of darkness. He's brought them into the kingdom of his Son. He holds them in his hands. He loves them as his children. But when you look at the circumstances of God's people now, you might say, well, there doesn't seem to be a distinction here, actually, in their circumstances. That God's general judgments, disasters, wars, sickness, suffering, death, they hit God's people as much as anybody else. There seems to be no distinction. And actually, in some ways, you might say God's enemies seem better off. At times, we may well echo the lament of God's people in Malachi 3, verse 14. They say this, "It is vain to serve God. What is the profit of our keeping his charge? Evildoers not only prosper, but they put God to the test and they escape." But the day is coming when this distinction between those who are God's people and those who aren't will be plainly seen again for all to see. As Malachi 3:18 says, "Then once more you shall see the distinction between the righteous and the wicked, between one who serves God and the one who doesn't serve him." On that day, the Lord will distinguish, he will separate the one from the other, like a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. These will go off to eternal punishment, these to eternal life. And that final distinction will be irreversible and eternal. And that is why in the present, God's acts of judgment are acts of love, because they're a megaphone to rouse a sleeping world. They're warnings to God's enemies to flee from the wrath to come. But where can they flee from the coming wrath? Well, to the cross. To the place where we see most clearly God's love in an act of judgment. The place where God, in his love, takes the judgment that we deserve on himself in the person of Christ. As Romans 5:8 says, God shows his own love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. I don't know if you've been following this story of the public poll to come up with a name for the new multi-million pound polar research ship. You're following this at all, this story in the news. 120,000 people voted for the name of this multi-million pound polar research ship. They voted for the name Boaty McBoatface. Boaty McBoatface. Four times more votes than the nearest competitor. But the government don't like it. They think it's not a good name for a multi-million pound polar research ship. There are other names which are, anyway, we won't go into, anyway, the government don't like it. They're killing off the idea. And there's outrage among the people And you get headlines like, you know, what gives them the right to trample over democracy like this? Tyrants have crushed the people's will. And people say, it may be a silly name, but the people should get what the people want. Absolutely, let's call it. Yeah. We like being able to choose, don't we, what we want. Whether it's names for research ships, or who's going to be the next mayor of London, or whether or not we should stay in the EU, or what goes on our pizza. We like being able to choose. But some things in life, we don't get to choose. Such as where or when you're born, or what the weather's going to do tomorrow, or what God is like. If we could choose what God is like, it would be a nightmare, wouldn't it? It'd be like giving a 5-year-old complete freedom to do what he wants. What would happen? Project 5 years on from that point. What would happen? Well, 5 years later, the child would probably be dead from ill health. You'd find that child lying obese in front of the television, Xbox control gripped in his little hand, surrounded by empty pizza boxes and Big Mac wrappers and LucasAid bottles and probably Domino's pizza. Imagine if what God is like was determined by a public poll, a public vote. What would we create? A God who would tolerate anything and everything? A God who would just give us everything we want when we want it? A God who was small enough for us to control? If it was up to us, we would create a monster. But thankfully, we don't get to choose. God is. And he has revealed to us what he is like. He has revealed himself to us as the Lord, a God who acts in judgment, showing his power and his justice and his love. A God who is worthy of our trust and worship and service. We don't get to choose what God is like, but whether or not he is our God and whether or not we are his people, that is a choice we get to make, a choice with consequences not just for now, but for eternity. So choose life. Choose life. We're going to pause for a moment to reflect on what we've heard, maybe to pray in the quietness, and then we're going to continue in prayer after that, and Anne is going to lead us. But first, let's pause for a moment of quiet.